Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Tales with Rand Dugas and Heather Fowler. Today, we are delighted to feature Deborah Spark, author of Discipline, published by Four Way Books.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? We thought that having a drink while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a great idea. Today we are drinking a Morrison Switchel inspired by Deborah's book. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog link in the podcast description if you'd like to make it and have one with us.
Deborah Spark is the author of four novels, two collections of short stories, and two books of essays on fiction writing. Her most recent books are the novel Unknown Caller and the essay collection And Then Something Happened. With Deborah Joy Corey, she co-edited Breaking Bread, a book of food essays by Maine writers to raise funds for a hunger nonprofit. Four Way Books will publish her fifth novel, Discipline, in 2024. Her short work has appeared in Agni, AWP Writers Chronicle, The Boston Globe, The Cincinnati Review, Epic, Esquire, Five Points, Food and Wine, Harvard Review, and others. In addition to writing book reviews, fiction articles, and essays, she spent a decade writing about home, art, and design for Shelter magazines and has been the recipient of several awards, including Maine's 2017 Read Me series, a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, a Michigan Literary Fiction Award, and the John Zacharias Plowshares Award for Best First Book. A graduate of Yale University and the Iowa Writers Workshop, she is a professor at Colby College and teaches in the MFA program for writers at Warren Wilson College. Of her novel Discipline that we feature today, Kate Christensen says, quote, "Deborah Spark is one of our most underrated great writers. Her new novel brilliantly concerns itself with the intersection of art and relationships, the ways in which works of art live in the world as lightning rods for human passion, rage, love, and loneliness, and the ways in which this dynamic quality of art shapes the loves of people who come into intense contact with it. Discipline is one of those rare books I want to tell everyone to read immediately." You couldn't have a better endorsement than that.
I agree. How does art mirror and shape our lives? Can it transcend the boundaries of time, wealth, and circumstance? Deborah Spark explores these themes in her new novel, Discipline. With a trio of important paintings missing, the book weaves together three narratives that span almost a century. From an inhumane boarding school in Maine in the late 1970s to a contemporary Boston art appraiser struggling with raising a teen to the long-lost love letters between a painter and his wife. Discipline is a propulsive literary mystery about family strife and devotion, ambition and authorship, and the abiding and mysterious power of art. Inspired by the life and family of Walt Kuhn, the painter responsible for the 1913 Armory Show that introduced Americans to modernism, and the scandal-ridden Elon boarding school that was forced to shut down in 2011, this richly drawn, suspenseful novel shows Spark at her most masterful.
How are you doing today, Deborah?
I'm good. Thank you. How about you?
Great. And we're so glad to have you here and looking forward to talking with you about your work, but also to having you give us a live reading a little bit later. Do you enjoy giving readings?
I do. I used to get very nervous, but now I like it, especially if people laugh. I don't know if I'm going to read
this. Yeah, that's good.
I like it if people laugh.
Do you write a lot of comedic work?
I like being funny if I can be. It's hard to force yourself to be funny. My brother used to be a stand-up comic, and we all like humor in my family. So I like it if I can be funny, but I think it's hard to push a button and say, now be funny.
That's true. Yeah. As I mentioned when I was describing your novel, it's inspired by the life and family of Walt Kuhn and the Elon boarding school. How did you connect these threads? And then how did you arrive at Gracie for your third character that would bind those two narratives together?
How did I connect the threads? You mean come up with even talking about those two things, or how did I relate them to one another? Both. Okay. Both of those things came to me by happenstance. The second one, the Elon school, which was a completely abusive therapeutic boarding school in Maine, where I now live, I actually found out about when I was giving reading, speaking of which, from my previous novel. And someone asked me what I was working on. And I told her, and at the time I was trying to write a book about the soup kitchen in Portland. It wasn't going very well. And then a different woman in the audience said, oh, were you there the night so-and-so died? I think I had said I volunteered at the soup kitchen. And I said no, but I knew people did, in fact, overdose in the soup kitchen, often in the bathroom, was horrible. And then she started to tell me about this young woman she'd known who had overdosed in the bathroom. And she had been an artist. She had been a ceramic artist. And she had gone to the Elon School. And I had never heard of that. So she started to tell me about it. And I was shocked, partially because the school is only 15 miles from my home and had operated for about 12 of the years that I'd lived in my home. And I thought, how did I never hear of this? So that's how I heard, first of all, about that. Actually, as I was interviewing a homeless man who told me he was the adopted son of Walt Kuhn. And I went home and I thought, that sounds odd. And I Googled him, it, Walt Kuhn, and I read something about a man, I think it may have been the homeless man who I was interviewing, but it might have been a different man, who burnt two paintings by Walt Kuhn by the side of the road when he was running from the police. So both of the stories fascinated me. And at the time, I was working on a nonfiction book that was going nowhere. And I think what happened is that because both the story about Elon involved an artist, it was a ceramic artist who died, and the homeless man's story of his own adoption, which itself was a dramatic story, involved an artist. And because I'm married to an artist and have spent a lot of times with artists, I think I found a way to take the project I was working on, which really wasn't working, and turn it into something that would work. So that's a long-winded answer. But I think I wanted to write about the haves and have-nots of Maine. I had been really compelled by my time at the soup kitchen, but I was just bogging down in my research. And I just stumbled really on these stories that seemed super interesting to me. And then the other question, Gracie. I think Gracie is, I think there's always a character who's somewhat like me in my books, and she's a character who's somewhat like me, although she's not me. So I wanted someone who could tell a story that paralleled the parenting stories that were in the other narrative lines of the story, but that was a contemporary parenting story.
Yeah, definitely. And I was very interested in the intersection of poverty and wealth in the book. And also, I was really interested in your real life work in the soup kitchens, as well as exposure to the Maine art world. How did you get started volunteering for the homeless? When did that come into your own life? I'm curious.
Well, that actually happened as the college I went to had a volunteer night, and I just went, and I was really struck by it. I actually went with my son at the time. I was very moved by it. And so then I thought, oh, I should be doing something. And I went back and volunteered once a week for about a year and a half. And in terms of the intersection of the world, so while I was doing that, I was working for mostly Maine Home and Design. And then I started working for other home and design magazines. But that was a really fun job because I got to drive all over the state, see these gorgeous homes. It was really my introduction to Maine, because even though I moved here and I worked here, I never really saw lots of little corners of it. And this was a way to see gorgeous homes, gorgeous places. But it also meant I was often in homes of the most wealthy people in the state at the same time, maybe even on the same day, I'd be seeing the least wealthy. So one couldn't help but be thinking about the extremes of wealth in this state.
I have a craft question. I'm interested in the structure of your book, and it includes chapters that occur in different times and places, as well as changing POVs. And so I was curious if you set out and you started your book knowing the structure of it, and then also did you work on one section at a time straight through, or did you move through them as they happened in the book?
I am trying to remember. I wrote it chronologically, but I rewrote it so many times that there are parts that fell out and came in as I went along. And there's things that seem major to me now that weren't in the first draft. Like right in now, the first chapter starts with Gracie's son running away from home. That wasn't even in the first draft of the book. Now, actually, the cover of the book is a boy running away. I think I mistakenly had a sort of a whole narrative line about Gracie's first marriage and her trouble in her first marriage. And that becomes pretty much in the background in this version. And I think I realized at one point that the three narrative lines that are in the book, I knew they were always going to braid together, but I didn't really have them thematically echoing and paralleling each other, or maybe had them thematically echoing but not paralleling each other enough. And I realized I needed to do that at some point in the process, that they needed to be versions of the same story insofar as they were addressing parent and adult relationships, how one disciplines in one generation versus another, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I really love the parallel storylines that you have going. And how many times did you wind up rewriting the book?
It's so hard to count because it's not like came through, stopped, and started again. Right. I was picking away at it. And I think I thought it was done, and my agent sent it out. And I think the editor's comments, I was like, yeah, that's true. So then we pulled it back and I reworked it. So it's almost hard for me to say. It was like many, many years.
Wow. Well, I definitely was focused on parenting as a strong theme in Discipline. You can't help but see it in all of the threads. But I was really interested in both the biological parenting and chosen families element of it too. Did you know when you started writing this book that the relationship between the protagonist of the braided narrative and her son would feature so prominently as bookends?
That I did always know. Yeah. I think I always have both a plot I want to be entertaining, but I have something emotional or an emotional narrative that is part of the plot, but maybe adjacent to the plot in a certain way. And so I always knew that was what I wanted to look at, because so many people I know, myself included, struggled with how to parent in the current moment, how to be a good parent, figuring out how to limit things, when to allow things. I always used to joke about my son, who I adore, but I was like, why didn't he come with a little book that told me what to do? Because one inevitably makes mistakes. And I think those kind of mistakes you so regret, and mistakes you make parenting, because you never want to hurt your own child. So I was preoccupied with that just because I was in my own life. And then I was so horrified by the decisions that the Elan people made, not always with ill will. I think there were some people there with major personality disorders who were running the place, but I think there were other people there who actually believed in the way that they were trying to supposedly help children. And yet many people who went through that program really suffer PTSD, I think, from going through the program. And I think some got through it and clearly have successful lives. Other people, actually David Sedaris' sister, Tiffany Sedaris, I believe that's her name, one of his sisters, the sister who killed herself, who clearly had mental health issues, but she had gone there. And I think, oh my gosh, what could have been worse for a person with mental health issues than to be shrieked at the way they were in this program? I mean, even if you didn't have mental health issues, I would think being shrieked at would be terrible. There are people who went there, children who killed themselves at high proportions. Obviously, I would never parent like that. And no one I know would parent like that. But clearly, there was some thinking at the time that was okay, or that was the thing to do, or this would be helpful. So that also interested me. And then in terms of the third narrative line, where the character, Reggie, who goes to that school, but managed to make his own associations and form his own family, even though he hasn't been born into a family where he has a lot of support, interested me a lot.
Yeah, for sure. And then just that whole thing about mental health and programs like that, it just evokes for me all those wilderness camps and Scared Straight and a lot of the kind of kooky psychological programming that was at play at different times and in vogue at different times. To me, it's evoking a lot of those different types of, I don't know, this is going to work for children. No, now this is going to work for children, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And Scared Straight was exactly the phrase they used. And I think at Elan in particular, they were like, this is the end of the road, basically. It's here or jail for your kids. It's here or death on the streets or something. I think a lot of parents probably were very frightened and didn't know how to maybe control their kids. Although sometimes when you look at what the children were doing who were sent there, they're the kind of thing that you or I or most people I know might send their child to a therapist for some talks, not to a place like this. So it just also shows you, obviously, how drastically different the thinking has become, thank goodness, in terms of how you help someone who's struggling. And some of them weren't even struggling that much. I might have smoked pot a few times, like very ordinary teenage behavior.
And then you contrast it with the protag, whose issues, I don't think I'm giving anything away in the beginning of the book, have to do with too much internet phone use, too many devices, that sort of thing. And you think, okay, and then the child is so angry when the devices are taken away. And it's such a contrast to the discipline model of the hyper-aggressive, violent kind of thing that you would see in some of the earlier generations.
Right. And I think I grew up with my parents weren't strict, I wouldn't say, but my parents told me something to do and I did it. And I think I even say this in the book, my parents had a lot of power. And I feel like in a certain way, or my own sense is that children actually have a lot of power now, maybe inappropriately, but it's hard to figure out, right? You want the child to be okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I put this in this book, someone told me, I was like, oh my God, that a mother took away her child's cell phone and he stabbed her. Well, obviously, that's quite a mental health issue right there. But I thought, oh my goodness, that is really shocking. So also what these devices and this connection means to children or teens is pretty interesting too.
Oh yeah, there's the potential for secret lives that the parents can't access.
Yeah, indeed.
Which is its own different world for parents too, right?
Well, I really loved how you talked about art in your book. And I thought it was a really different perspective that we don't often see when art is a subject in a novel. It's like the behind the scenes, the appraising, as well as how to deal with an estate. And then you had like an art lover. So there was all kinds of great things that I really connected with. I was also really drawn to the themes of birthing and creating that run through all the storylines. Yeah. They're so complex, yet they still all connected for me. And I was wondering if you could talk about how you see art and writing as forms of creation.
Not sure I have a good answer for that, although I like that question. I mean, I should have a good answer, but I don't. I've always loved art. I majored in philosophy in college, but I might have majored in art history. Always loved going to museums, married a painter, and go to museums a lot. But then also, all these years I was writing about home and design, I went to homes with a lot of art, sometimes really good, sometimes not so good. But and then after all this time living in Maine, between my husband being a painter and then going into these homes, I started to have a pretty good sense of the art scene here in Maine, which has been interesting. And then issues of authorship interest me. I guess that's obvious in the book. And also, I sometimes feel, this is going to sound terrible, I love art, and yet I sometimes feel artists make too much of themselves as if they're like geniuses or God, all power. I was like, it's art. The idea is I think we can somehow say the unsayable or articulate things that might go unarticulated. And I think that's all a virtue. But I'm also sometimes interested in people being a little too puffed up about what art can do. So I think I wanted to touch that on the edges. And then also just the struggle to make a living and the choices people make because they're struggling to make a living. So without giving something away, some characters here make a choice that one understands why they did it, but it's a problematic choice in order to move ahead the career of the primary artist who in my head is so invested in his career as an artist that it does crowd out other things.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm just going to echo that for a minute, that I think it was so lovely to move back into a fine art landscape. The book almost gave me a feeling of nostalgia because of how lovely it is to be in a museum world and an art sales world out of a digital world. Does that make any sense?
Yeah,
To be in a tactile world and a physical things space, I think that was quite lovely. But also the narcissism of the artist, all of this seems to be an old school feel of a book theme, which was lovely to re-embrace. I guess I'm just connecting with that as well. And yet there was a modernity element to it too. So everything, all things in the book, which was lovely. But I also wanted to say you've written so many books. So how did you feel this one felt in terms of its place in your larger trajectory?
Yeah, that is an interesting question. I don't know. It's hard to judge your own books and stuff. I felt like my last book was called Unknown Color, and it's about marriage. And I feel like this book, in my head, they're my strongest books, but I don't know, of course, because it's me. But I felt like in both cases, maybe I was getting closer to what I want to do as a writer. I'm not entirely sure. Although right now I'm writing nonfiction, and there's part of me that's not sure I'll ever write another book of fiction again, which is an odd thing for me to realize at this point in my life. I'm 61. It's starting to think maybe I'm through with fiction because story ideas have not been coming to me. What's been coming to me is the idea of writing essays, which is what I'm doing now. I think to a degree, if I look back at what I've written, everything's attached to something in my life. So my first book, although it's not about this, I'm a twin, and I had a younger sister who died young. And that was my preoccupation. She got sick very young and died very young. And so that was my preoccupation, was the preoccupation of everyone in my family. And I think I wanted to write about it obliquely, but not write about it directly. Then my second book, I wrote about it directly and probably too quickly. And in both cases, those books were set in the Caribbean, in part because I loved magical realism. And I think I wanted to be a magical realist without maybe coming up in that tradition, but also because my paternal grandfather lived off and on in Puerto Rico and did a lot of business in the Caribbean. So he had a lot of connections down there that he's put me in touch with. And then it's funny, my third book, I think it's called Good for the Jews. And I think I was thinking about academic politics and how difficult people in academia can be. But again, I wanted to write it about it maybe more obliquely. So it's actually a retelling of the Esther story from the Bible, but in contemporary times. And I'm Jewish, and it used to be hard for me to keep my Judaism out of my work. In fact, my mother once joked, she goes, why are all your characters Jewish? They don't need to be. I was like, I don't know. They just are. To a degree, maybe I write, if I think about the major subjects, it's always connected to where I am in life. like marriage. I was thinking about marriage, parenthood. I was thinking about parenthood. My son's now a young adult. So maybe I don't want to think about fiction now because the next step's death. And maybe I don't want to think about that. So that's not exactly a good answer. But I do think every book is in a certain way tied to a stage of life, even if the subject is different.
Yeah, that makes sense. In an interview I read, you said that many of us are better writers when we're older, that writing is dependent on life experience, which kind of connects to what you were just saying. Can you talk about that a little bit more? What makes you feel that way? And also, do you think the same thing applies to all of the arts, that we're better at it as we're older?
Yeah, no. And I did say that, but just to put the thought in context, I do think there's some arts like music or visual art where you can be a prodigy when you're very young. I think the reason that you can't be a prodigy when you're very young in writing, with some notable exceptions like Carson McCullers or something, is that it's an art form that's not just form. It has a content, and the content often, not always, is based on life experience. So that it's not that you can't turn a beautiful sentence, I think, when you're 23 or something, but I think life experience often, not always, improves the work. I'm thinking of Donna Tartt. She's a notable exception. She wrote her first book when she was still in college, as did Zadie Smith, brilliant book. So obviously there are tons of exceptions, but I think in general, it often helps just to have some years under your belt, which you don't need in other art forms. I don't think.
That's interesting how they're different, and people come to them differently at different ages. I really also loved your portrayal of Maine in the book, especially in that first chapter. Like, I felt like I was there when poor Gracie's in the middle of nowhere in the freezing cold. And so I was wondering how you were setting details into your story. And can you give new writers suggestions how to incorporate elements of place? Are you doing it in rough draft stage? Do you go back and place some more in at revision stage?
That's a good question. First of all, I think I'm bad at place. So thank you for saying that. I think I'm really bad at physical description. I often think, I don't feel like I can't describe bodies. If someone asked me, what does someone look like? I'm always wanting in my head, I'm like, oh, she looks like this actress or that actress. And I always notice when I actually read other people, I was like, look, they're not just describing the hair color and whether they're thin or not or whatever. And I was talking to a friend actually named Heidi John Schmidt, and we were going for a walk and down the road near my house. And I said, look at this, look at these trees and everything. I could not describe this for the life of me. And she said, oh, I can do that in a heartbeat. It's dialogue I can't do. And I was like, dialogue I can do a heartbeat because I know how people talk. So I actually find physical description and place difficult. That said, that particular scene, I did in fact go to an island off the coast of Maine to write a house article on an incredibly cold January day. And I took the boat way out. So it must have been an island. I can't remember which one, but like Final Haven, far out, super cold. And the person who was supposed to pick me up forgot to pick me up. So it all worked out. I found someone. But my first thought was like, oh, what if it was the last ferry? What if she wasn't picked up? So I think in that case, I lighted a lot of the islands that I had been to and things I had seen on islands. So it's not any particular island, but it's a lighted version. And I think when I'm doing physical description, but even when I'm writing in general, I think I do tend to collage things I've seen. Obviously, I'm making things up. It's a collaged version of observations I've had through time. So that scene was very much that. And then just imagine would have happened if I had to go to the place I was going to in the middle of the night instead of during the day. I found someone with a car who took me where I needed to go.
I have to say, I loved the ferry. I loved the walking in the cold. I loved the discussion about the coats. I was obsessed about the coats. I don't know. I mean, I could have dwelled reading about the coats for like 12 pages. I don't know. I'm a kind of coat obsessed, as you can tell.
Well, Heather, where are you from? Do you live in a cold
place? I am from, originally born in Los Angeles, but for some reason, I think I had a past life in Russia. There's this weird obsession with LA. I can't explain it. I live in San Diego, where, as you may know, it rarely gets below 30 degrees at night. It's mostly 70 degrees, and yet I have 50 coats. Anyway, but I loved the puffer thing, the interesting hypothermic note. I could have dwelt in that forever. But what I was really interested in here, too, was I was thinking as I read this book, because there were so many different types of narratives, so many different types of characters. You're a teacher. You're a college professor. You teach college students regularly. If or when someone is teaching this book and they write to you, what do you think that you would tell them should be the main takeaways you'd ask them to ask students to write about? Or if they asked you, hey, what do you think students should be asked to write about up with this book? And what did you learn?
For a literature class instead of a creative
class. Yeah, right?
No idea.
obviously you're a literature teacher, so I'm like,
no, I'm not. I just teach creative writing. I don't teach literature. I mean, and okay. When I teach, it's so funny. When I teach writing, it's always as a writer, like reading as a writer.
Okay.
So actually, I was just like prepping for my Wednesday class, and yeah, we're obviously we read it as English students do, so we're looking at what it does. That's interesting. I don't know if I could ever answer that question, just because it's my own work. How you can't? It's how do you do it?
Okay. Well, if not that, what did you learn as a writer from writing it?
Oh, the biggest lesson was, I think, that thing I've already described, that I thought was, I always knew I was going to braid the narratives together. But it seems to me obvious that obviously they needed to parallel each other. But I just didn't get that until probably too late in the process. So that, I think, was a really important lesson. And I've always been aware, books that I most like have overlying metaphors, extended metaphor that goes across the book. Like I was just writing about this book I love called So Long, See You Tomorrow, which is a gorgeous book for many reasons. But one of them is there's this sort of metaphor of a house that returns again and again. It's a narrative bit of business, but it's also a thematic bit of business. And it's a symbol, and it gets overlaid in many ways. So I think that kind of thing, which I think you only do towards the end, once you've figured out the story or how things are going to work, really interests me, how to layer up things or have associations and echoes across a narrative, which just seems like almost like the fun work after you figure it out. The plot, because I feel like you also want to entertain and you want the plot to work and you want there to be surprises. And I feel like that's always been the hardest for me, figuring out the plot. And in fact, part of the reason I had written the book Good for the Jews as a retelling of the Esther story, I thought, oh, if it's a retelling of the Esther story, I don't need to figure the plot out. I'll take that from the Bible. Although in fact, I did have to change it. But I thought that would be great. Then I have that off the table and I can do all the fun stuff. Because I think sometimes the fun stuff is figuring out the other aspects.
Right. Super interesting. We are looking forward to hearing you read an excerpt from Discipline. But before we do that, Ran, can you tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for Discipline?
I can. Today's drink is actually a mocktail, and it's called a Morrison Switchel. The recipe's on the blog if you want to make one and have one with us. The ingredients are, it's a 2-inch piece of ginger, 2 teaspoons of apple cider vinegar, 1 teaspoon of honey, some still water, some sparkling water. And you peel and cut the ginger into slices. You boil it in a cup of water for about 10 minutes. Then you add the honey and the vinegar and you let it cool. You strain the mixture into a glass filled with ice and top it with sparkling water. And if you wanted to make it a cocktail, you could add an ounce of rum. Deborah suggested this drink and I've had it and it's so delicious.
You can also make it with maple syrup or honey, depending what you've got in the house.
Wonderful. Deborah, would you like to tell us a little bit about the passage you'll be reading for us today?
Yeah, I wanted to read the first few pages of the second chapter. It doesn't need any setup because it comes to us from a different point of view. The only thing you need to know is it takes place in 1978. And I have to say, I was very much thinking of my own junior high school when I wrote it, even though this is about a boy from Bridgeport, Connecticut. So the chapter is called Farewell. Spanish was first period, so Reggie was dozing in one of the mobile classrooms when a tall, middle-aged man, dark-haired, with a round, sweaty face, shook him roughly awake. Okay, buddy. Okay, come on. What? Reggie said, instinctively shrugging the stranger's hand off his shoulders, a get off of me springing to his lips, though he didn't speak it. You're coming with us, the man said. What? Reggie repeated. The man jerked his head toward the door, as if Reggie were confused about the avenue of egress, not the reason for it. Who are you? The classroom, so ordinarily stifling, was suddenly electric. Something was happening. That's for me to know and you to find out, the man said, schoolyard style. Was he for real? Improbably, he was wearing a long duster coat, even though it was early June. Already so hot, the city's newspapers were full of angry letters saying the school year should be shortened. Kids couldn't concentrate in the unair-conditioned classrooms. Next to the stranger stood a short, beefy guy wearing a white t-shirt, jeans, and a Red Sox cap, which was confusing in a different way. Bridgeport wasn't a city where people wore baseball caps, and if they did, it was for the Yankees. Ay, caramba, what's going on? Said the olive oil-shaped Mrs. Funes, hand to cheek. Behind her were the magazine pictures from Spanish-speaking lands that she'd taped onto the blackboard. She always talked in rapid, overexcited Spanish, and no one could tell if this was a Ricky Ricardo imitation, the way she really talked, or something she affected to get the class motivated. It didn't tend to work, whatever it was. But now Reggie's classmates were livening at the possibility of drama. Nothing really good had happened all year. He's coming with us to the principal, the bigger man announced to the room. He handed Reggie a soft-edged hall pass, confirming the official nature of the errand.
hall passes only came from one office. Reggie had not, to his knowledge, done anything wrong. Not recently, anyway. What for, he asked. There'll be time for all that, the man said. Nice coat, a kid called from the back of the room. The garment looked like something a pimp might wear, and Reggie assumed the kid, it was Noah Tremont, that bonehead, had the same thought and was offering the insult disguised as a compliment. All right, whatever, I'm coming, Reggie said. He stood and swung his backpack over one shoulder and offered a broad shrug to convey to his classmate that this was a mystery to him, too. At least he wasn't going out in handcuffs, never to reappear, as one kid had in English last year. He followed the man out of the classroom and down the hall, walls painted in what Reggie thought of as milk of magnesia white to cover and then recover the swears routinely scribbled there. He was really tired. He was always tired, so he wasn't even thinking, what's going on? More like, okay, man, whatever you want. Later, of course, much later, he'd wonder why he didn't think to start asking questions right away. Why didn't he think to resist? Had he been able to avoid the situation he was about to step into, his life might have gone in an entirely different direction. Could he have stopped things? Who might have helped him if he had realized that, at that very moment, he was in profound need of help? In there, the tall guy said, once they got to the office, gesturing not to the principal's door, but the vice principal's. Reggie wasn't exactly surprised. The principal was a good enough guy. He looked a little like that game show host, Gene something. Match game something. Gene Rayburn, that was it. Anything that smacked of punishment rested outside the principal's purview, and with Vice Principal Jackoff, who was an indisputable asshole. The vice principal's actual name was Jack Jacket, which should have been the first indication that he shouldn't work with teenagers, or that his parents were drunk when they named him, or too stupid to think of a different first name. Everyone called the vice principal Jackoff, or J-O, or Joe Job. Sometimes even the teacher slipped and called him Mr. Jack. What's up, my man? Reggie said with brash, false enthusiasm when he entered the vice principal's office, a place where spider plants went to die. Reggie aimed his arm exuberantly so Jackoff could offer him a high five. When Joe Job failed, Reggie examined his hand as if wondering what was wrong with it. He sniffed his palm as if that were the issue. Then, making a face to indicate everything smelled fine to him, shrugged before slumping into one of the two chairs in front of the vice principal's desk. I see. A smart guy, said the tall man, as if he'd already figured Reggie out. Reggie yawned theatrically, though in fact concern had finally woken him. The vice principal waved the pimp guy into the seat Reggie hadn't taken and pressed the intercom on his phone to ask the secretary to bring in an extra chair, presumably for the beefy sidekick. Okay, Reggie knew he was supposed to stand till all the adults had a chair, only why should he? If the beefy guy had been pregnant or super old, Reggie would have given him the chair, but basically Reggie felt his rest slash beauty sleep was more important than the beefy guy's, as the beefy guy had a ring on his finger. Thus a wife, ergo did not need to look hot as the day wore on. For with Reggie, good looks were essential to his getting out there, mating, and continuing the species. This all ran through Reggie's head as a line of thought he might share with his friend Gilbert later, complete with the ergo and even the words QED, end of proof, something he'd started saying after taking geometry last year when he was a sophomore. The rumor was that Jackoff had come back from Vietnam with a metal plate in his head. Whenever Reggie saw Jackoff, he wondered where the plate actually was, and even though he knew she should be focusing on Goon 1 and Goon 2, today was no different, despite an internal rumble of anxiety, his tectonic plate shifting slightly. What could these guys possibly want? The back of Jackoff's head was peculiarly flat, so maybe there. J.O. combed his hair flush with his scalp, and the strands were greasy in a way that had to be about some product like Vaseline. Who could possibly think this was a good look? Like, did you ever see an actor on TV with his hair matted to his head with grease and think, bingo? Might it not occur to you that the reason there was no model for the very look you sported was because no one anywhere wanted the very look you sported? Reggie, these gentlemen want a word with you, the vice principal said when everyone was seated. Gentlemen, of all names, especially given Jackoff's chosen name for Reggie was generally Punk, as in, listen, Punk, when he had something illuminating to offer, like Reggie was going to be suspended if he skipped school again, a punishment that struck Reggie as both counterintuitive and welcome, but whatever. Reggie had stopped skipping. Not because he wanted to be in school, but because he didn't want to hang out at home now that his foster dad had been laid off from the shipyard. Attendance didn't change Jackoff's attitude about Reggie. People said Jackoff was nicer before the war, but who could imagine that far back, to Jackoff as a soon-to-be scarred high school kid, instead of a king whose robes were an ugly tan-green suit, his kingdom the high school cafeteria, and his scepter the microphone that he slapped into his hand repeatedly before he raised it to his lips to bark out a reprimand. You didn't need much of an imagination to picture Jackoff using the microphone as a club to beat an unruly kid. He had learned a few things in Vietnam. "We understand you've gotten into a little trouble down here," said the pimp-looking guy. "Who's we?" Reggie said, looking around broadly, then peering at the dust bunnies under his chair as if to figure out where the committee liked to hide. "The state is making a very generous offer, thanks to Dr. Busso," Jackoff put in. Busso was the social worker, sans medical degree, thus with fraudulent title, who Reggie had been seeing ever since he'd gone into this weird-ass vegetarian restaurant, and the truth was he'd done a little something, kind of been a little rude. Pulled a small prank, rocked a boat, ham to ham bone, freak to freak, boogie oogie to little oogie. Reggie offered a bland, "Yeah?" but what he thought was, "Oh shit."
Oh, that was great.
Yeah, so good. Thank you.
I wanted to ask you about the publication journey for this book and also how you found your agent.
Well, the agent is a fun story. My agent is my former student. Her name is Eleanor Jackson. She's wonderful. And it's great having a former student as my agent because I feel like the agent author relationship, the agent's a little like the parent and the author's the child, but then the teacher-student relationship is the other way around. So I'm always curious how she's doing and very, I don't know. It's really nice having someone. She's so smart and she has been very good to me because I am not what you would say a high-earning author. I started publishing with New York presses. I published with smaller and smaller presses and she has stuck with me. And honestly, I'm not sure another agent would have. So I feel very lucky to have her. And then with this book, as with my last book, even though I think they were my strongest books, it got rejected a lot of times before it got taken, which was super discouraging.
Oh, yeah.
But that is the way it is. And I feel like also that is the way it is for maybe a writer who's where I am in life. And I try, of course, when I'm going through it, it's very upsetting. But with my last book, I honestly felt like my last book, Unknown Caller, got rejected so many places. And then I had such a positive reaction to it from readers after it got published. I thought, well, that is interesting. And of course, fingers crossed that maybe that will happen with this one. I don't know yet, but I have the people who have read it have been very positive. So that's nice. It's such a hard business. And
yeah,
it just is. And I certainly have tons of graduate students who I think are beautiful writers who can't get their books out there. Ditto friends. And then I also have friends who've done fabulously well and won Pulitzer Prizes. So I know it's hard. And I feel lucky that it did come out. I wish it hadn't been rejected before it came out, but I'm glad it's way into existence all this time.
And to a certain extent, it's all pretty relative, right? Because some of my favorite writers died in poverty. And then they come to this amazing posthumous acclaim and are read 200 years later. So really, and then there are some authors who are Nobel laureates and no one knows their name.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You just got to think to yourself, what is it that makes it an amazing book? Is it when several hundred years later they're of the duration? Because it surely isn't necessarily what's marked a hit today.
Yeah, I feel like I know some people, fame and fortune. I think what I want is to be able to keep doing it, right? I don't want to get into a place where I write a book and it doesn't come into existence. And that's mostly what I want out of my publication, a future as a writer. And I very much want people to enjoy it or be moved by it or whatever. But I realized my biggest goal is to be able to keep being a writer in a certain way. I have a day job since I teach, so I don't need it to earn me money. I would like if it would, but I don't need it to. But I need it to enable me to keep being what I've been.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, I think this is really important. And I think this is why Ran and I always ask the same question to all of the, how many now, Ran? Maybe 30, 38 writers we've had on Book Tales so far. And we always ask this question because we always like each person to bring their own stamp to Book Tales about it. And we always say, hey, what advice would you give struggling writers or even those just starting out? What is the best writing advice you can offer? So I'm going to give that to you, Deborah. What would you tell our writers?
Oh, keep at it.
The plain fact is people who are good get rejected, but also people who are bad get rejected. And you don't know whose work isn't great. But if you love it, just keep doing it. I have actually a kind of nice story. And it actually also involves a former student. Years ago, I was at a writer's group with a man named Jim Thompson. And he sent me a memoir he had written, which I found beautiful. And he'd had it rejected everywhere. I was like, I think you should keep with this. I really think it's a good book. And then I got an email out of the blue. And not only had he sold it, and I think a good sale after it had been rejected everywhere, he sold it to another former student of mine. I was like, excellent. That's just happenstance. That just happened to be a coincidence. But the fact that this woman named Juliana Hobner, that's the name of the editor, that she bought it, or she was with the team who bought it, just made me so happy because I thought she's smart. And I felt really glad that he hadn't given up on the book because I think he was on the edge of giving up on it. And it's coming out when he's 80, when he's turning 80. I was like, so you never know.
Yeah, for sure. Wonderful. And thanks for that advice.
Thank you for all the questions. They were great. It was really fun. This is my first interview about the book, so it's really interesting to hear what kind of questions you asked. It was really fun.
We're so excited and we enjoy talking to you. Thank you for spending time with us at Book Tales today. We really love also hearing you read your work.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Of course. And everyone, please order Deborah's book, Discipline, and be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the Book Tales readings and drinks. Also, check out Hot Redhead Media's new sister podcast, Heat, which celebrates women's contributions in TV and film, and subscribe to Book Tales, which releases once a month for more conversations with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Book Tales. See you next time.